Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wedding bells and much more today for Prince William Arthur Philip Louis of Wales and his college sweetheart Kate Middleton. They emerge from a short, sweet Westminster Abbey ritual as the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, in line to be one day, perhaps, the King and Queen of England. It was a traditional ceremony with hints of modernity, the dress, the celebrity guests, the live YouTube broadcast. It's said that billions of people around the world will have seen the ceremony. And yet, in the year 2011, after all of world history, why is it that we still have monarchs at all? This hour on Point, a royal wedding and the persistence of monarchy. You can join the conversation. Were you up early, glued to the television, the trumpets, the carriage, or couldn't care less? Why does the world still have kings and queens? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the Archbishop of Canterbury solemnizing the marriage of Prince William and Kate Middleton in Westminster Abbey today.
William Arthur Philip Louis, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together according to God's law in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honour and keep her, in sickness and in health, and forsaking all other, keep thee only unto her, so long as ye both shall live?
I will.
He will, she will, they do. It's done, they're wed. Joining me first today from London is Mark Evans, head of home news for Sky TV. He's been covering the royal wedding. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
That's no problem.
So everything gone to plan so far? Everyone happy in London with the festivities?
Everybody's absolutely delighted here in London. I have to say, I'm sure you can appreciate this has been months in the planning. It's taken hundreds of people both today and in the lead up to. I mean, that's just from our perspective. I mean, you can imagine how many people have been involved in the planning of the actual wedding. But yeah, it's gone off like a dream, both in terms of coverage and in terms of the event as well. The pictures have been wonderful. I'm sure you've been seeing them over there, and everybody's delighted. I think they're saying 2 billion people seen it around the world, and the latest figures we've just had in the last few minutes from Scotland Yard suggest that there were more than 1 million people on the streets around Buckingham Palace and along the route that the happy couple took today.
You're with Sky TV. Can you think of any other event that might have 2 billion people watching it?
I can't. I genuinely can't. You'd have to go to something like a Soccer World Cup for such viewing figures, but no, I really can't. There's something very special, I think, about the pageantry involved and the history involved in a UK royal event like this. I think, you know, no matter what, I heard your tease into your stories later on this hour.
Yes.
And I think no matter what your views are on whether or not the monarchy should or shouldn't exist in this day and age, I think everybody, or most people perhaps, have a soft spot for the kind of, you know, the romance and the glitz and the glamour and the colour that goes on. So unprecedented, I think, and like you, I can't think of anything else that would hit these numbers.
Mark, what's the commentary you're hearing so far from maybe British observers on the ceremony, I don't know, the dress, the actual ritual itself, and people's presence there? How's it being characterised?
Well, overwhelmingly, in fact, entirely positive. The event itself, we were concerned in the couple of days running up to today that it might rain, that we might have thunderstorms even as the couple were coming out of the church, but that stayed away. It wasn't massively sunny, but it was bright enough. It looked lovely. The dress was fantastic. It's from a kind of very modern young designer, and very clean lines, very pretty, a very modern event. And I think in the run-up to and during today's service, I think a lot of people over here and a lot of the commentators are seeing this as a kind of almost a new beginning for the royal family. You know, we've had or they've had, I should say, their share of controversy and their share of troubles over the past 10, 20 years. But I think this is seen as not only a new start for them, but the beginning of a new generation of royals. You know, there's a feeling that William and Kate are very much, you know, very much more grounded in the reality of people's lives as it exists in the UK at the moment, rather than perhaps being seen as, you know, a remnant of something past.
Those royal troubles, not least the divorce of Charles and Diana and the death of Princess Diana, what nods or echoes to or of Diana did you see in the ceremony today?
Well, there were lots of little touches. I think, Kate's mum, Carol, wore a dress which was made by a designer who had been, popularised by and very much supported by Diana. So that's seen as something of a nod too. But I mean, I think without too much specific reference, it was felt that, you know, the image, the feeling of her kind of, you know, permeated the whole event, really. I mean, all the broadcasters over here were running pictures of her today and pictures of William, when he was young with his mum. So there's a feeling that she's never been kind of very far away from it.
A big party at Buckingham Palace tonight, and then what for the newlywed couple, Mark?
Well, do you know what? That's a question in my job here as head of home news, and I'm desperate to have answered myself. As you say, there's a party tonight. I'm told that it's going to be a pretty good one. I know that William's brother has organised a 6 a.m. wedding breakfast for those of them who have stayed up right throughout the night partying and carousing. So I think that's one specific next. But after that, we're just waiting to see what happens, really. I understand that they will be in London in the palace overnight. And then we're understanding that they will go... they will leave London certainly tomorrow, but in terms of location and where they will spend the rest of their honeymoon, it's pretty much anybody's guess at the moment. There's lots of rumours flying around, but certainly none that have any grounding in fact, as far as I'm aware.
Well, Mark Evans, head of home news for Sky TV, joining us from London. Thank you very much, Mark.
That's a pleasure, and if you do hear where they're going, let me know, won't you?
Well, you'll be the first to know. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it.
Here's the sound of crowds gathered in London for the wedding of William and Kate today. Joining me now from London is John Burns, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and London bureau chief for the New York Times. He's covered countless countries and crises. Today, he's been watching a royal wedding. John Burns, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Also with us from London is Helen Castor, British historian from Cambridge University, author of Blood and Roses and She-Wolves, the women who ruled England before Elizabeth. Helen Castor, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us on this day.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
She-wolves, and you're talking about she-royals. Do you see a she-wolf in Kate Middleton now, she who's wed to William?
Very much not, no. There's not even a hint of the she-wolf about Kate. My book, which is about queens of England in the Middle Ages and mm-hmm. the 16th century, is about women who managed to wield power, which, of course, was what the monarchy was all about then. Mm-hmm. Now we have a very different system of government, and the only kind of power the monarchy really has is cultural. It's a very different beast.
John Burns, capture this moment for us in kind of that arc of monarchy. You've written about it recently, at least the 20th century monarchy in the UK. As you watch these two young people this morning say their vows, where do we catch the British monarchy?
Well, it's been 25 rather difficult years for the royal family, notably, of course, in the divorce, the disintegration of Charles's marriage to Diana after the last great wedding. Mm. 30 years ago, but sundry other indiscretions and more recently questions about the probity of some of the royal finances in specific reference to one of Queen Elizabeth's second son, Andrew. They've not been very good years. The monarchy has been sustained by a kind of bedrock support in this country, which has endured, and it tells us, I think, that it's likely to endure. If it could endure this, it's likely to endure much more. It has, in the past, endured worse than this. Of course, in the 17th century, we had a civil war here, mm-hmm. in which we ended up by cutting off the king's head. Today, I think, did mark a watershed moment. There's certainly a great yearning in the public for a renewal of the monarchy, to put all of this unhappiness behind us. And I think there's a great pride that I sensed out in the streets today, simply at the UK's continuing ability to put on a show like this. And it's commonly said here, nobody does it like the Brits. I think that's probably true when it comes to royal weddings.
Lots of monarchs, royals in the pews today at Westminster Abbey. Helen, we just have a few seconds before the break, but do you see a fresh start here, or is it too much to hope for after all the troubles John referenced?
No, I think we are possibly seeing a new dawn in the sense that if the monarchy is going to survive, I think it needs to connect with people, with the people in a positive way. And William and Kate have show every sign of being a couple who actually like each other, which is the best possible start we could have at this point. So in terms of carrying this forward, an institution where really their only job is to be and to procreate and to look happy, they've made a pretty good start.
Kate Middleton walked up the aisle today to the anthem for the 1981 wedding of Prince William's parents, Prince of Wales and Lady Diana Spencer then. I was glad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking today about monarchy, the royal wedding in London, and why monarchies are still around. You can hear some of the reason right here in Voices today from London, one woman who came to Westminster Abbey for the wedding.
We're very patriotic. We love our royal family, supporting them. So they're great. We're both Kate and Will fans. We wish them lots of love and happiness for the future.
Lots of love and happiness for the future. CNN spoke with a couple of young women camped out to ensure a spot along the royal wedding route. They said it was a big event for themselves and for England.
This is a monumental wedding. It's the first wedding to a commoner.
It's like an actual fairy tale. It's a real fairy tale in real life. She's going to become a princess after marrying, like,
Prince
William.
Charming.
Yeah, Prince Charming, exactly.
It's amazing.
It's the best day of British history so far.
Yeah, I think so.
The best day in British history. Things are getting really wrapped up there. You can join the conversation this hour. Were you up at the crack of dawn to see Britain's royal wedding today? Why? And why Americans of all people, the republic, the democracy that rejected the crown, is it all about the fairy tale? With British historian Helen Castor, author of She Wolves and Blood and Roses, and New York Times Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, London Bureau Chief John Burns. Let's hear just a little bit from Kate. Here she is with her vows in Westminster Abbey.
I, Catherine Elizabeth.
Take thee, William Arthur Philip Louis.
To my wedded husband. To have and to hold from this day forward. For better, for worse. For richer, for poorer. In sickness and in health. To love and to cherish. Till death us do part.
Kate, there this morning, now married into royalty. Helen Castor, can you help us out from the history perspective on this, on the commoner front? Is it, in fact, indeed, absolutely the first time ever there's been a commoner married in at this rank in the British royal family?
Absolutely not, I'm afraid. No, you can go back hundreds of years and find commoners marrying into the royal family. Henry VIII, one of our best-known kings, after all, got through quite a few wives, most of whom were English commoners once he got rid of the Spanish Catherine of Aragon. So Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Catherine Howard, Catherine Parr, all English commoners. And if you go back further than that, Henry VIII's grandfather, Edward IV, actually secretly married a beautiful widow who already had two children, who was on the wrong side in the Wars of the Roses. And he married her because she wouldn't agree to become his mistress. So he just went ahead impulsively and married her and got into terrible political trouble as a result. So, no, there are many, many stories going back through British history of commoners marrying into the royal family.
And yet, John Burns, this coal miner's granddaughter, the fact of her commoner status in the British parlance as opposed to Lady Diana seems important this time out.
Do you know, I think you can overstate that. Mm-hmm. I think the British public would have embraced any normal, healthy young woman, which, of course, Kate, now Catherine, I believe we have to call her,
okay,
manifestly is. It may help a little bit, yes, but, you know, people would have been out in the streets today cheering. There would have been great hubbub if she was already, you know, royal by blood, at least a blue blood. It's rather nice in many ways that she isn't, but I don't think it's critical.
I think the other point historically, if I yes. can come in there, is that there's also this question of what royal blood actually is. I mean, clearly, cuss us and we bleed. There is no mm-hmm. difference right. to be seen between royal blood and other blood.
You can
and
call actually, it blue, back, but it's not.
It's not, and you go back through the dynasties. I mean, again, you look at the Tudor dynasty, for example, ended up on the throne because they won a battle, not because they were actually stuffed full of royal blood. So the British royal family, one of the keys to the survival of the British royal family has been pragmatic politics. It's not about, you know, the chemical makeup of a drop of blood. It's about being in the right place at the right time and managing to survive.
I heard someone quipping today, I mean, in thinking of the way that the marriages, royal marriages, have been made to consolidate and expand power over the years, that in the old style, Helen, it would have been, you know, a British prince marrying these days, I don't know, a princess of China or a daughter of Barack Obama or something. That's not the way it's working this time.
No, it isn't. But then in those old days that you're speaking of, monarchy was a system of government. It was real political power we were talking about. Political power came from God and was delegated to one unique individual. Therefore, if England wanted to improve its position in Europe, or Scotland indeed, then alliances would be made, and royal marriages were the literal embodiment of those alliances. You'd put two people together to symbolise that union. Now, of course, the political process is elsewhere. And the question really, therefore, remains of what royal marriages are for and how they should work. We, I mean the British people,
right.
seeing them now as they ought to be love matches, supposedly. But Charles and Diana showed how difficult that can be to pull off.
Some of those relationships accepted and some not. Here from December 10th, 1936, King Edward VIII renouncing the throne, famously for the love of American divorcee Wallace Simpson. He spoke to the nation.
I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love.
John Burns, you've reported from all over the world. I'm sure you've reported in countries that have royalty still. And, of course, there were many just in Westminster Abbey today. I mean, Belgium's crown prince and Denmark's queen and Norway's king and queen and right on down. Spain and Sweden and Netherlands and Serbia. And go around the world. So many more. I mean, we've heard recently the voice of the Emperor of Japan speaking to the nation on the tsunami and nuclear crisis there. You can find so many. What do you think is behind the persistence of this, John? Is it just entropy, just history still playing itself out? Or is it possible that we'll see monarchies going on indefinitely?
You know, it struck me as you asked that question that the places I've spent most of my lives had a kind of royalty, an authoritarian leadership. Chairman Mao Tse-tung was, in yeah. many respects...
No crown, but plenty of scepter
in a way.
A royal
and irreproachable personage.
Yes.
But I don't know, I'd have to think about this, but I think you could probably say that relatively, places that do have royal families have done pretty well. It's hard to think of a country immediately that had a royal family that descended into, in modern times, the kind of brutality and violence that I spent a lot of my life covering.
It's at the doorstep of Jordan right now in Syria. There's been talk of the Saudi royal family potentially being in trouble. I mean, I don't know about the Arab royal family.
Well, we'd have to take the measure of what comes after. Mm-hmm. I think that we may here be in the case of you know, be careful of what you wish for. And yes. We're not talking about the Middle East, but there are many ills with which you can reproach the monarchs of the Middle East. But just wait a while and see whether what emerges from all of this is appreciably better.
Helen, same question to you about the persistence of monarchy in your country and beyond. I mean, do you see this as just a relic with a very long half-life, but inexorably, you know, going towards some twilight and then extinction, or something that, for whatever reason, may go on and on and on in the human experience?
I think there are probably two ways of seeing that. The one argument would be that it is a measure of the maturity of the political system somewhere like the UK, that we have this continuity in our political system, and what the monarchy provides is continuity of structure within which politics, political debate and conflict can play itself out. Another way of seeing it would be that it's a demonstration of the immaturity of our political system, that we haven't yet managed to design for ourselves a political structure based on the democratic principles that we now claim to espouse in government. In a sense, the English Civil War, the English Revolution, happened too early and was all about religion instead of being about the fundamental principles of the way our government was organised. And so the monarchy, okay, having managed to survive that the period when, as John said earlier, Charles I was actually executed and the monarchy abolished, it has come to be one part of a parliamentary system. So I suppose it's what we're talking about is evolution against revolution. And historically, it's a very difficult thing to say which is the more positive. Clearly, both can be long-lasting in effects, but a lot depends on local context.
You're talking about continuity there, yes. There certainly has been that. I mean, here's a little tape from King George VI, famous again this year as the subject of the Oscar award-winning film The King's Speech. Of course, the brother of the king who had renounced the throne. He overcame that debilitating stutter to give a radio speech at the outbreak of World War II, and here he is. British continuity, September 3rd, 1939, announcing that war has been declared.
For the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war. Over and over again, we have tried to find a peaceful way out of the differences between ourselves and those who are now our enemies. But it has been in vain.
King George VI, September 1939. Fascinating. Now, having seen Colin Firth struggle his way through it, to think of him in those pauses, maybe struggling with a stutter. But John Burns, I mean, you've seen so much. Give us your reportorial gut check here. Do you see a kind of evolutionary, inexorable decline in royalty? Or do you think it could re-up again and again somehow in our vastly changing circumstances?
Are you speaking here of the British monarchy or of monarchy in general?
Well, I mean, they're not mutually exclusive, are they? I guess we could start with the British and look beyond.
It's a lot easier for me to talk about the British monarchy, which I know so much better. I've been struck, actually, in the last month or so, with how, in the face of the events of the past 25 years that I spoke about earlier, and how sorely tested the loyalties of the public here have been
to a dysfunctional family,
how enduring, in fact, support for the monarchy is. Mm-hmm. The Guardian newspaper, left of centre newspaper, which sounded a very dyspeptic tone in its editorial this morning about the wedding. It wasn't clearly outright Republican, but very close to it. I published an opinion poll on Monday, as I recall, in which the simple and most declaratory issue raised, ICM poll, was, do you think that we would be better off without a monarchy or not? And 63%, again, this is in The Guardian,
Yes.
Which is edging towards republicanism.
Mm-hmm.
Its sister paper, The Observer, the Sunday paper, is outright Republican. At least it was in its editorial.
As in, no monarchy, please. Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, saying that, you know, the course is run, really.
Mm-hmm.
But The Guardian itself found 63% saying we'd be worse off, 26% saying we'd be better off without a monarchy, and the remainder saying they don't know. I would say, you know, a politician would consider that to be a pretty resounding affirmation.
Yes, yes. In poll numbers, there's no question about it. John Burns, Helen Castor, stand by. We've been keeping so many listeners waiting. Let's turn to them. Anne in Kingston, Massachusetts. Kingston, no less. Anne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm calling to talk about love.
Great. Let's hear it. Love and monarchy?
Love in general. I think we're celebrating love today in a very public way. I think it's something that brings all of us together in a more powerful way than any war. And I think we should feel more comfortable talking about and celebrating love and happiness and overcoming personal obstacles.
So I take it that when you watched this morning, you were less enamored of the pomp and circumstance than of these two just making their vows.
Well, that's what it's really all about. And I think the monarchy is not party-driven, but a very unifying force, and it brings balance to the political scene. And I think it's something that we should all celebrate and feel more comfortable celebrating.
Well, a few hundred years after we went to war to push it off, but Helen, I mean, there is something here about the way monarchy puts human drama into such an enormous spotlight for us all to contemplate. Whatever you think of the monarchy, I understand what Anne means there this morning. You're watching an extremely public attestations of love, you know, the full formality of a wedding. It brings ritual before the public in a way that maybe has a lasting role, even if you're against the monarchy.
I think it's important to stress this is a new feature of what the monarchy does. In centuries past, a royal wedding would have been a private affair in terms of, you know, I mean, clearly, obviously, before the mass media, no, you know, millions couldn't have seen it. But coronations were the great public spectacle of the British monarchy. And I think this is part of the monarchy trying to find a new role for itself now that it is no longer political. It almost becomes our sort of national soap opera. And there are two ways of seeing that. I think it does divide people rather more than you might have got the impression from some of the reporting that's going on. Many people do clearly feel that this is a great boost for Britain, a young couple in love making their vows, representing, as your listener just said, love in a public way. Others feel that this is the wedding of two fabulously wealthy and privileged young people on which wedding millions of pounds of public money has been spent at a time of great economic hardship in the country as a whole, and really feel it as a kick in the teeth rather than a shot in the arm. A third way of seeing it, I think, which is worth mentioning, is that, of course, we have a much and ever-developing celebrity culture in the modern world. And interesting, of course, to see David and Victoria Beckham turning up among the congregation here. In a sense, it is possible to see one element in the survival of monarchy as slipping into part of that celebrity culture, and people are tuning in just as they would for the Oscars to see the frocks.
It was a micro moment to listen and watch as each said in their vows this morning, for richer, for poorer, and realize they, as you say, do represent quite enormous wealth. And yes, there, Elton John and the Beckhams, but also a whole lot of royals in that elite crowd inside Westminster Abbey, and many, many more outside and around the world watching. We'll go out with Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer. This was the last hymn sung at Princess Diana's funeral, and again this morning at the royal wedding. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking today about monarchy, the royal wedding, and why monarchies are still around. And check it out. Look anywhere you like. It's easy to find online. There are many in the world going on quite well today. After all the revolutions and all the political evolution, all the beheadings, if you will, and uprisings, plenty of monarchy is still there. The British monarchy getting lots of attention today with the royal wedding in London. Helen Castor joins us, British historian, author of She Wolves and Blood and Roses. John Burns is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, London bureau chief for The New York Times. It's not all royal majesty, pomp, and circumstance. The Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, gets right down into details. Here she is with her annual speech before Parliament. This is last year's, discussing the budget, war, and also some rather modern issues that need upgrading.
My government will support investment in new high-speed broadband internet connections, enable the construction of a high-speed railway network, and reform the economic regulation of airports to benefit passengers. My government will modernize the Royal Mail in partnership with employees and will ensure it benefits from private sector capital and disciplines.
The Queen herself getting into the details of new high-speed broadband internet connections. You wouldn't have that in Henry VIII's time. But, Helen Castor, just think for a moment with us, if you would, just for a historic perspective. I mean, if Henry could have been in the balcony looking down, any of the Henrys, on this wedding today and the scene outside, what do you think they would have made of it as a mark of how this monarchy has evolved?
I think they would have been absolutely delighted to see their bloodline or a version of their bloodline persisting in the place they would believe they should rightly be. But I think they would be absolutely horrified at the clip that you've just played of Queen Elizabeth II reading out somebody else's words about the policies of her government. I think any of the Henrys would have felt that Parliament was there to be told what the King wanted to do and not the other way around. So I think, you know, part of the strength of the British monarchy and the reason why it's still here is its rather protean ability to change and evolve and adapt itself, even to rather unpropitious circumstances, as the last couple of hundred years have been, really, for royalty. But if you hold on and you carve out a rather different kind of place for yourself in society, that is to be above the political fray, then clearly there is still a place for a monarchy in providing a sort of framework. I think there are questions perhaps one ought to be asking in a democracy about whether that's a framework that works in exactly the way we want to. And I do think it is very interesting that, as you said earlier in the programme, that the United States, which is a country that deliberately rejected monarchy, should now feel so warmly towards the example that the British monarchy sets. It's a very interesting paradox.
It is fascinating. I mean, many warmly. Others, I have to say, I saw rolling their eyes today. But the full spectrum is definitely there. Let's get a call from Ontario, Canada. Aled is calling. Aled, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you about this. I want to make two points. The first is that when we are talking about the democratic, oh, by the way, I'm a Brit that's living in Canada
right
now, and I'm of Welsh origin. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the democratic monarchies of Europe, you know, Sweden, Norway,
yes,
Denmark, and the Netherlands, these are very stable countries. Now, not so stable are perhaps the monarchies of other countries that are not democratic. And people like to get behind a person rather than behind a sort of a state. And I think this is why we have the popularity of the royal family.
Is it a good thing? Is it a good thing, Aled? Or do you judge it good?
I'm sorry?
Do you judge it a good thing in that case?
Oh, I do indeed. I'm not a celebrity follower, but I must say, when I saw Prince William, I guess he's Duke of Cambridge now, when I saw him chatting with people along the parade route, and they were laughing and talking, I expect there were big, burly men protecting him at some distance, but I got a little frisson of pleasure at seeing that, because it seems to me that now the monarchy is modernizing. The firm, which is what the Queen calls the royal family, is modernizing, and I think it will last. I hope it lasts, because when I see other countries, such as yours, for example, and I'm not being critical, but when I see other countries that have a head of state and half the people in the country criticize him for this or that reason, I'm kind of glad that we haven't, that they and us, because there are 18 countries that have the British monarchy, I'm glad that we have an unelected head of state, even though, yes, it is not democratic in the strict sense of the word. But these are democratic monarchies. They all have parliaments. They all govern according to elections and the will of the people. And the second point was, somebody mentioned that the cost is enormous. Well, you know, the cost of having any head of state is something. And in this case, I believe the royal family is picking up part of the cost. And you should look also at the blip in the gross national product that is going to happen.
Adele, we've got it. I think they are picking up maybe the party cost, the security cost, $32 million I'm reading here in USA Today, borne by British taxpayers. But I appreciate your call. John Burns, you write for The Times. You're there, but you know American politics pretty well. I mean, there are times these days when people wonder who can get above the polarization in the United States. I don't think that leads people to yearn for a monarch. But is the British monarchy above politics in the UK? Everyone noticed there were some notably missing former prime ministers there today in Westminster Abbey.
Yeah, that did seem like a rather foolish and spiteful thing to do, and was not at all explained, at least to the satisfaction, I think, of the British public, by what the palace had to say about these two, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, not being members of the Order of the Garter. There were five former prime ministers at the Diana Charles wedding, and two of them were not members of the Order of the Garter. It looked very much as though personal animus on the part of some very senior royals was involved in this. And that may not exclude the Queen herself, who did not like Mr. Blair for the way in which he tried to manage her and the royal family at the time of Diana's death in August 1997, mm-hmm. A story which would be familiar to anybody who saw the film The Queen. But, you know, Helen's talked about the function of continuity that the royal family provides, mm-hmm. and at its best, it can also set an example in so many things. Of course, it hasn't set a good example in recent times. It set a very bad example in some respects, and I thought that what you just mentioned, the exclusion of the two prime ministers, was regrettable, because otherwise they've managed this wedding almost impeccably. But it was significant, I thought, listening to the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of London today. It seemed to me they were trying to convey a message too. As one of your listeners called in and said this was about love, I think that the Church of England and the British public in general would very much like to see a royal marriage that worked, that prospered, that is really a marriage of love, and which the two involved make a big make the work of making it work, if it's not mm-hmm. a redundancy, mm-hmm. Set an example. This is a country in which more than 40%, close to 50% of all marriages fail within 5 years, and in which something like 50% of all children are born out of wedlock, if I recall the figures correctly. And without taking a moral position on that, I think that this young couple there's a great burden on them to make this thing work and to be an example in that, as in so many other ways.
Let me get one more call, if I may. Our time grows short, but Sarah in Belmont, Massachusetts. Sarah, thank you very much for calling.
Hi. I'd like to make the point that there's a large percentage of people, it seems to me, who have the medieval peasant mentality, and they love to kneel and grovel before pomp and pageantry. It's kind of similar to the way people grovel before the Catholic Church with its gorgeously dressed cardinals and bishops and palaces. And it's just that. I mean, it's just some people, there are a lot of people who just love to grovel.
Why do you think that's why monarchy is still around, Sarah? It satisfies a need to grovel?
Yes, because there is this, there's abject, I mean, there are a lot of people who really don't, maybe democracy is for people who are somewhat more intelligent, and since a large portion of the population is not, so.
Listen, I'm all for democracy and intelligence, but honestly, did you really see groveling in the streets of London today or a celebration?
I mean, the way people were talking about Kate and how beautiful her dress was, how beautiful she looked, how handsome the prince was. The prince is ugly, bald, 29-year-old man.
I can see it's not for you, Sarah. I can see it's not for you. Our time is short here, but I appreciate your call. Helen, there's the pushback, just having none of it, you know. Doesn't want this kind of ranking of humans. It's not for the intelligent citizen of a democracy, Sarah says.
Well, I think there is this problem, and this is bringing us back to what we were saying earlier about the whole concept of blue blood. You know, some people being more special simply by an accident of birth than others. And that is the huge problem with the idea of using a family as the stable apolitical structure within which you build your democracy. Because they may be unpolitical in terms of their public role, but the difficulty is what it does to the social structure and the class system. You know, the idea that there are some people who are born more special than others, and that is something that people do have a profound problem with. So, you know, many people love the idea of 1,000 years of royal continuity, although, as I said earlier, the story is actually rather more complex than that. But it does leave us with social problems about how we want our society to function.
Well, it's been very generous of the two of you to be with us today on this day. Helen Castor, author of Blood and Roses and She-Wolves, the women who ruled England before Elizabeth. Helen, thank you very much for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
And John Burns with the New York Times in London. It's always wonderful to speak with you. Thanks for joining us today, John.
It's a pleasure.
In a moment, one writer's take on the deeper meaning of Kate and William's wedding. This is On Point. Like many Americans, writer Joan Wickersham has been watching the run-up to the royal wedding from afar. She reflects here on our fascination with Kate and William and the royals, and all we don't know about the fairy tale.
35 years ago, the edgy British novelist Peter Dickinson wrote a murder mystery called King and Joker, set in Buckingham Palace. I don't remember anymore who was murdered or who did it. What was memorable about the book was Dickinson's fictional royal family. Suppose the king were a doctor, and the queen a quirky intellectual, and the children restless and itchy and curious. Suppose, in other words, that they were a normal family, trapped in an abnormal position, at once accustomed to protocol and hampered by it. What would they think, and how would they feel? And that, of course, is the fascination of a royal wedding, with its numbing slow-motion pomp and its occasional flashes of human spontaneity. We watch from the outside and wonder what goes on inside. What are they thinking? Are they or are they not just like us? What really interests us isn't the coaches or the dress or the kiss or the rock stars or who sits where in the abbey. It's the weird permeable but impermeable boundary between royalty and us, and watching as it gets crossed. That boundary crossing, in fiction and in real life, is the primal stuff of fairy tales, both romantic and creepy. There are, in fact, two archetypal princess stories: the commoner who gets to be royal, Cinderella, and the frustrated royal who runs away from the job, Audrey Hepburn in Roman Holiday. Some stories deliver both. Mark Twain's The Prince and the Pauper lets us become both the poor, hungry kid who wants to get inside the gilded cage and the pampered brat who's dying to bust out. And in real life, there was Diana, whose 16 years on the public stage was an ongoing drama of becoming and unbecoming a princess. She gave us both stories at once, the gorgeous outward trappings and the trapped, regretful inner monologue. Oh, what is she thinking, we wondered dreamily on her wedding day back in 1981, as the extravagant meringue of her billowed down the aisle toward her prince. Well, she told us later in one of her riveting, pathetic, crazy-like-a-fox press interviews, I felt like a lamb to the slaughter. At the very moment of getting in, she wanted out. Even though Kate Middleton is a lot more like us than Diana was, her father is a party planner, not an earl, the spectacle of her crossing the boundary from commoner to princess is a lot less dramatic. She isn't a blushing Cinderella. She's a polished grown-up, marrying a man she knows and taking on a job she understands. When she and William gave an interview at the time of their engagement, they were polite and charming, but also cool. They told a few carefully chosen personal anecdotes, but the really personal stuff stayed private. When asked if they were excited, William, likably, compared the two of them to ducks. Calm on the surface, but beneath the water, their feet were paddling wildly. In marrying Prince William, Kate Middleton isn't just crossing the boundary between commoner and princess. She is walking into a cage. It's fancy and privileged, but it's also restrictive, and it could be hellishly lonely if, like Diana, you found yourself stuck inside it with people you didn't like. Peter Dickinson's fictional royal family, grumpy and thwarted as they were, had a rich private life together. It was partly a necessity. Being royal maroons you, but partly a godsend. They found one another interesting. You don't have to tell all to the public if you can comfortably tell it to each other. So, what are Kate and William really thinking? We don't know. They don't need to tell us. They seem to like each other, and they seem to know what they're doing. Royalty is a job. A wedding is public. Beyond that, it's none of our business. They'll show up for ceremonies, smile for the photographers, and then go live their lives beyond both boundaries, that of royalty and that of privacy. From a myth-making perspective, they're duds, which, in its intuitive grasp of the way fairy tales can backfire, is brilliantly sly and deeply romantic.
Writer Joan Wickersham on The Royal Wedding. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.